Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Matt Chorley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Coming up on today's episode, as a new biography of Keir Starmer reveals his dad was a toolmaker and he grew up in a pebble dash semi, we ask, can you have too much backstory? We'll speak to not one, not two, not three, but four political biographers to see what the upbringing of a politician makes to their prospects of being Prime Minister. We'll also bring you a sneak preview of today's How to Win an Election with Peter Mandelson, Daniel Finkelstein and Polly McKenzie. Plus, Joe Lycett takes on sewage in a new Channel 4 documentary. He tells me why he's wading through the brown stuff and how does his polling match up to Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak. And if you like what you hear on the podcast, don't forget you can join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits on Times Radio, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. That's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. Now, as we always like to, on the Tuesday episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits, we bring you a little sneak preview of today's How to Win an Election. It's Peter Mandelson, Polly McKenzie and Daniel Finkelstein. Today, talking about how you win in a recession. Can you?
In a very, very good book called Why Message Matters by Lynn Vavreck, the political scientist, she essentially shows the strong relationship in US elections, this is, but I think the same occurs here, between economic performance in the last 6 to 9 months before an election and expected performance in the 3 to 6 months after the election, in terms of people's welfare, their disposable income, and that the relationship of that to voting. And then she asked the question, can you actually buck that? You know, if you're the candidate that is running for the opposition party and the economy is going very well, or you're the party that is running with in the government and the economy is not going very well, are you doomed? And she argues, no, you're not completely doomed, but it's very difficult. That's the first point. But then she says, can you do anything about it? Yes, you can select an issue which you are able to campaign on, but your opposition, the other party, cannot. And you can try to elevate that into the issue for the election.
I mean, it's perhaps what they're doing is trying to just dump the economy as an issue, as an election issue. I think it's extremely hard to do that for all the reasons that Danny has explained. But that's perhaps why they're turning to small boats, Rwanda, immigration. But the problem with them for immigration is that they are stoking up a great deal of sentiment and anger amongst conservative supporters, as well as some others, but many, many conservative supporters who, angry and disappointed at the government's performance over immigration, are now turning to Reform UK. So what we've seen over the last few months, as they've banged the drum over immigration without providing solutions to it, is that support for Reform UK has grown. And that's what we saw in Wellingborough. And I think we'll see it in others. And the Reform UK, from a Conservative point of view, are in danger of taking off if Farage joins their campaign. If he hits the campaign trail between now and the election, he will put booster rockets under Reform UK. And then I think the Conservatives will indeed be well and truly sunk. So I don't think going on about immigration and boats and whatever is the answer to their problem.
But he's only got so many things he can keep talking about. Polly, I thought I'd look at the polling on this just to see how badly they're doing. Actually, in terms of how the public think the government's handling the economy, I mean, it's low, but the number of people saying they're handling it well is going up. The number of people saying it's handling it badly is coming down. And if you look at which government would be better at managing the economy, the Conservatives are on 20, under Rishi Sunak, are on 24%. Labour on 27, neither on 28. The Labour and the Conservatives are basically neck and neck on this. It's not like Labour are winning on the economy either. It doesn't feel like. But maybe that doesn't matter if you're not the government.
They're not massively ahead, but they are slightly ahead. And crucially, they're ahead on everything else. And if the Labour Party is ahead on the economy, the Labour Party sort of takes for granted that it's ahead on whether they do public services well. Mm. And they're also ahead on immigration by some measures. And again, partly because of the reason that Peter was just explaining, that the more the Conservatives talk up how tough they are on immigration whilst continuing to fail, the more they actually kind of push votes away from themselves and they push up the salience without dealing with their competence problem, and actually they get worse ratings on that. So there isn't another issue, as Danny suggests, that the Conservative Party can actually pick on that works for the centre. It's that, you know, it's like in chess, right? You're in check, and so you have to move. But the problem is that every move actually puts them into a worse situation because they're trying to move to the right to pick up the anti-woke vote to stop reform taking them, but all they're doing is making the problem worse.
And you can listen to the full episode of How to Win an Election wherever you've listened to this, but not before you've listened to Joe Lycett. He's previously taken on councils, breweries, food delivery firms, banks, oil companies, Hugo Boss and David Beckham. Now, Joe Lycett is talking sewage. In a new documentary on Channel 4, Joe Lycett versus Sewage, the comedian wades into the nation's rivers and ends up feeling a bit sick.
There's something nasty floating in Britain's water.
Oh, that stinks. Oh, my God.
And Joe Lycett's on a mission to flush it out.
They're going in the water. You know what's in there, right?
I don't go and swim in the sea anymore. Why would I want to go and swallow what I got rid of 3 hours ago?
Something horrible has happened here.
Why not? Bit of fun, isn't it? Because when I did the research on it, I say I did the research, when a team of people did the research and handed it to me while I was sipping Chateau Neuf de Pape, I was furious about it. It's really shocking when you actually see the scale and the level of poor investment and how long it's been going on for, how complicated it all is, and how many people are getting sick every year from swimming in basically raw sewage when they think they're just going for a dip in our seas and rivers. I started to get really angry. And when I get angry, that generally makes for good television.
And the thing about sewage, because sometimes if there's like a scandal that people are cross about, the more you dig into it, the more you work out, oh, hang on, there is this thing and there's another thing and it's complicated. But this is just a straightforward thing of, in 2024, we are routinely pumping poo into rivers and seas where people might want to go swimming.
Exactly, yes. And they refer to it as a spill. But a spill sounds like, oh, I've spilt a glass of Chateau Neuf de Pape. Whereas actually a spill in their terms is actually often leaking sewage for hours and hours and hours a day. Sometimes it's just like a spill can go on for hundreds of hours. So it's full leaks. The volume is hard to quantify, but there's basically, you know, massive amounts of raw sewage going into our rivers and seas pretty much every day. If you look at the map of where is safe to swim around the UK, it's basically not anywhere. You know, it's extraordinary how we've got to this position where we're an island and we can't swim in our seas.
Were you previously someone who went in the sea? Have you stopped going in the sea as a result of doing this?
Matt, I live in Birmingham. I couldn't be further from the sea. But what I do, yeah, I like to go in the sea. I like cold water swimming, and I like to go in the sea when I can, when I'm, you know, when I'm at the coast. But these days, I just wouldn't. You know, I think it's dangerous to go in a lot of the waters around the UK. And you hear of people getting illnesses that are permanent. It's not like, oh, I get a bit sick and then I get over it. Some people get inner ear infections, which change their lives forever. It's not something that is quick to get over a lot of the time. This can be life-changing for people.
So you take this issue, and obviously, you know, there's an issue which people have been banging about, the Times had a campaign for the last year on rivers and all that. Mm. So you discover that this is an issue, you get cross about it. How do you Joe Lycett it up?
Yes. Well, we always get with my shows, we always have a really strong journalistic team. So we have a really good journalistic team on this, as we always do. And so we try and merge their journalism essentially with comedy and try and make it light and entertaining and not too newsy, but with strong journalistic background. And we've got a whistleblower from one of the main water companies who we speak to in the program, who gives us some really shocking revelations about the kind of culture at these companies and how bonuses are paid out to the executives there, and how in some cases, according to the whistleblower, there are incentives to not report spillages and leakages at. Is leakages a word? I'm going to go with it. Leaks.
I mean, it's no more euphemistic than spillages. When, like yes. You said, they are literally deliberately turning the taps on.
Yes, yeah. Leaks sounds like the vegetable to me. So leakages. There's an incentive to not, because of bonuses are linked in some cases to the reporting or not reporting of these leaks. And by leak, I don't mean vegetable. So, yeah, we've got a lot of, I think, really shocking revelations in the programme. And then obviously, because there's loads of poo stuff, I just do a lot of scatological humour around. and that's it. And we're, you know, hoping for another BAFTA.
So what are the stats that leapt out to me? Because it's quite difficult to quantify this. Is that if you took all of the sewage overflows, leakages, spillages that happened in 2022, if it was all coming out of one pipe, it would take 200 years.
I don't. This is the tricky thing. Is like, what's the width of the pipe, and you know,
that's true.
Speed is it coming out? And this is the thing I tried to sort of quantify in my head when we were doing the program, and it's basically impossible because the data is kind of vague. You know, they spilled for so many hours, but what does that actually mean? And nobody really tells you because they don't want you to know, essentially. But I did a sort of back of an envelope bit of calculations, and one spillage I worked out was about the volume of three Titanics. And that was one spillage at one stage. But it is really, really hard to kind of get a sense of it because it's deliberately, I think, probably vague.
In the documentary, you do some very Joe Lycett things. You create stunts in the hope to go viral and, you know, wind people up and aggravate them and whatever. And you struggle a little bit to start with to get people sort of motivated by it. Do you think it's because do we just accept now, oh, nothing's worked, everything's broken? Of course, it's poo with the rivers, but we can't do anything about it. Is it just a...
Yeah, a bit. I think so. Yeah, I think there's a bit of that going on. But also, I think when anyone sees that I'm doing anything, they sort of go, oh, what's he up to now? You know, I think I've been rumbled. But well, I am really thrilled that at first it sort of didn't quite catch fire, and then suddenly it did. And we have had over 20,000 emails to the water companies. I think that's growing. And you can still email the water company. We've made it very easy. If you go to turdcast.co.uk, all the information is there. And it's literally like you just click on your water company and you can send them an email. Essentially, we've got to keep maintaining the pressure on them. Keep the thing in the news. Keep the thing being talked about, because the scale of the thing is a national disgrace, you might say.
So what is it? Because having motivated people, wound people up, what is it you want to happen? What's the purpose of getting people to email to their water company?
Yeah, so there is a simple solution to this, which is we need investment in our sewage network on a massive scale. And that sounds simple. It's like a one sentence solution, but there are ways of getting there. And one thing that I'm pushing for is that the water companies stop paying dividends. Now, our program says that I can't remember exactly what year it was, but basically on average 11% of the money that goes from your bills to the water companies gets paid out as a dividend. So that means that if you're paying monthly bills, one whole month of your bills goes straight back out to a shareholder, a pension pot, whatever it is, a hedge fund, to pay those shareholders. Full disclosure, I am also a shareholder in Severn Trent because my dad bought me 4 shares in Severn Trent when I was a little baby. So I get my last dividend payment was £2.56. I am part of the problem, but I'm disinvesting. I don't want to be paid that money. I want that money to go back into the system to improve it. And I'm calling on other shareholders to pressure the water companies to not pay the dividends and fix the problem. If it was a company that was essentially they're failing companies, if it was any other failing company, you wouldn't be expecting them to be paying dividends. You'd expecting them to reinvest and to make sure that it becomes a successful, profitable, safe company. And at this point, I wouldn't call all of our waters pretty much being unsafe to swim in safe.
Now, we had Steve Barclay, the Environment Secretary, was on Times Radio this morning, and he was asked about your show and some of the revelations, particularly about, you know, the Church of England has got investments in the water companies as well, which I know you talked about. This is what he said.
We do need to hold the water companies to account more strongly, and I'm absolutely determined to do that. You'll have seen, for example, my announcement last week in terms of bonuses for executives. There's a lot more to do. I do think, actually, if there is serious criminal wrongdoing in the industry, that does have a deterrent effect on investment, and it is something we should take seriously. But at the same time, we do want to secure investment because we recognise to clean up our rivers, to get the investment into our sewage treatment plants, that is going to take significant capital. We therefore need to ensure that investors are able to invest in those firms. But in doing so, we need to address the serious wrongdoing. And that's why, for example, in areas like water firms marking their own homework, doing their own inspections, that is something I'm extremely keen to stamp out.
So what do you think of that?
Well, it's a start, isn't it? A very small start. I do think, you know, they're obviously, you know, aware of it, and they are making some changes, and I don't want to discourage them from going further. So I think, well done. You've done a very good first attempt, Stephen. Have another go. Slightly better than Therese Coffey. I think we could go a little bit further, and I wish you all the best.
This is very positive. I'm enjoying this. This is a new, positive, upbeat Joe Lycett. I want to ask you about the government more generally. Obviously, you famously were a big supporter of Liz Truss, but that didn't last very long.
Yes.
When Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss were on Laura Koonsberg's show, you said there was no point speaking to Rishi Sunak because he wasn't going to become Prime Minister.
Yeah.
Confirming your reputation as a political pundit. How is he doing? Has he turned out to be better than Liz Truss?
It's very hard to quantify what better is, isn't it? Is it better to fall off a cliff or a bridge? it's hard to know, isn't it? I think it still feels like it's a mess, and it feels like they don't really know what they're doing, and that there's sort of chaos behind the door of number 10. And I think the Rwanda policy and the kind of mess around all of that shows you that the thing is on thin ice. So I think he presents well, and he, you know, looks nice in a suit, but I think there probably are people in the country who might do a better job.
Now, are you one of them? Because I've looked this up.
Yeah. I would be better at it drunk, I think.
Well, I've looked up your polling, Joe Lycett. I've been on YouGov, and I've looked up your polling.
Oh, no.
On net favourability, so all the people who are positive minus all the people who are negative.
Yeah.
Rishi Sunak is on minus 26.
Yeah.
Keir Starmer is on minus 12.
Yeah.
Joe Lycett is on plus 33.
Yeah, but the thing with that is I've not got involved in politics particularly, and the minute you get involved, you just drop into the minuses. So I think that's... I think I would be very low minuses if I started to try and get involved in politics.
We'd take low minuses. That's all right. That's an improvement.
Yeah. No. Like in high minuses then.
High minuses. Some people will think, oh, you're just another lefty comedian telling everyone to vote Labour.
Well, I'm not telling them to vote Labour because I'm not aligned to any political party. I'm not telling anyone to vote in any way, really. I sort of, I think people should vote, but it's up to them how they want to vote. So that has been one thing that I have found tricky, is that I didn't want to be a political comedian. You know, I started out doing letters about parking fines and...
Which are very funny.
Thank you very much. Thank you. another plus from the YouGovers.
I'm constantly having to explain to people that doth butter no parsnips. I say it all the time in meetings.
Yeah.
And I think it's basically your... I mean, I was aware of it as a phrase, but it's basically your fault because you had a...
Yeah,
the whole thing on it. You had a book called it. Yeah.
But I won't be telling anyone how to vote because it's not my place to. But I do think it's acceptable when you've got a government who have really consistently behaved badly to talk about that, and to my business advisor just tried to come in. Yeah, I think it was Rishi Sunak smashing through the door. I think.
But presumably you'll carry on doing it if there is a change of government. That's the point.
Yeah. I don't think you're going to fix all problems.
Yeah.
There's still going to be things that I don't know. Maybe Keir Starmer will win and he'll fix everything and everyone will be happy. Then we can all quit. You will have nothing to do.
I'll have nothing to talk about. You'll have nothing to talk about.
It's part of the ecosystem, isn't it? Pays the mortgage.
Lovely Joe Lycett there. Right, up next, the never-ending backstory. Do we need to know, do we care about a politician's upbringing?
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
The Big Thing.
This is me.
I spent most of my youth in South London until well into my 30s at different houses. Can we turn left into Atlantic Road in a moment, please? This is really the heart of Brixton. Once you come down the main road, turn left into the market. It's where Brixton takes its heart from.
Well, at home, really, was very small and we had nomad cons. And a grocer shop wasn't just a place where you bought groceries. You talked.
Do you consider that in today's Britain, drug-taking at university is a normal part of an ordinary university experience? David Cameron, what's your view?
I think politicians, like other people in life, are entitled to a private past that should remain private.
From growing up on a council estate and, you know, having my son at 16 and... Yeah.
My dad was a toolmaker. That pebble dash semi was everything to my family.
Yeah, it's the never-ending backstory of politicians. John Major, raised in Brixton. Margaret Thatcher, the daughter of a greengrocer. David Cameron taking drugs while he was at Eton. And did you know Keir Starmer's father was a toolmaker? But if you didn't already, you're going to know a lot more about the Labour leader soon. There's a new book out all about him. Keir Starmer, The Biography. Cracking title. It's by Tom Baldwin. It's out later this month, revealing more details of his humble upbringing in a pebble dash semi. But just how important are the backstories of our of our politicians? Is there any value in them? Well, to help us find out, I'm joined by a cracking panel of expert biographers. We'll hear from Sir Anthony Seldon. He's known for many political biographies, including those of John Major, Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, Theresa May, David Cameron and Boris Johnson, their time in Number 10. We're also joined by Linda McDougall, the author of Marcia Williams, The Life and Times of Baroness Falconder, who, of course, was a key advisor to Harold Wilson. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
We've got Andrew Jimson, who's written two volumes of biography of Boris Johnson, the most recent called Boris Johnson, The Rise and Fall of a Troublemaker, at Number 10. Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
And Francis Elliott, former political editor of The Times, now at The House magazine, and biographer of David Cameron. Cameron, practically a conservative. Now, Francis, let me start with you, because in a way, your biography of David Cameron is the most comparable to the one of Keir Starmer, although you weren't a Conservative Party press officer before writing it. What's the value of the backstory of getting to know someone who's sort of on course for Number 10, do you think, Francis?
I think we're always entitled to know the character of the person who has so much power over our lives. And it would be extraordinary if we didn't know a little about their emotional makeup, their background, their conditioning, their journey into politics. So I'd say it's actually essential.
And you did, I mean, the drugs, the taking of drugs at Eton, that was not known about before you wrote about it in your book.
No, nor indeed the picture of him at the Bullingdon. Or I think he had done quite a good job until book with James Hanning came out about just how privileged a background he'd had in the leafy folds of Berkshire.
And the reaction to it when that book came out, because clearly you weren't doing it, you know, to explain, Tom Baldwin was a previously a journalist at the Times. He then was a spin doctor for Ed Miliband. He's been in and around the Labour machine. Clearly this is, he insists it's not an authorised biography, but he sat down with everyone involved, and clearly, you know, he would rather there was a Labour government. Yours was more journalistic in that sense. And what was the reaction from David Cameron when your book came out?
I have somewhere a fairly nice note from Cameron. He said something to the effect of, "I'm not sure my mother would quite recognise her son in this," which is beautifully kind of barbed. But, you know, Everly kind of nicely brought up. He did send me a note. We met. He kind of teased me that we'd missed a few of his girlfriends. and I think he was more angry when the subsequent kind of updates came out. I think the revelation that he was would get a gold medal for chillaxing, which I think came out just as he was a G7 with Barack Obama. He was fit to be tired, I'm told, although I think I didn't see him at that point.
Yeah, I remember that only too well. Andrew Jimson, is there, I mean, the thing that strikes me is that Keir Starmer's, you know, this biography, clearly he's cooperated with it. It's portraying him as his humble upbringing. Clearly he had a very tough relationship with his father, and the house was in a mess, and money was clearly tight, and his mother was ill, and so all of that and so on. And it's clearly designed to make him seem more normal, a more empathetic individual. Andrew, it strikes me with Boris Johnson, an even more extraordinary upbringing, really, than David Cameron's. It didn't make the blindest bit of difference to his popularity for such a long time.
It was a very extraordinary upbringing, privileged but also precarious. His parents moved 32 times before they got divorced. His mother had a fearful nervous breakdown and was 9 months in the Maudsley Hospital. And at school, I got hold of his school reports, and his housemaster said that Boris expected to be an exception to the system of obligation that binds everyone else, and thought it was very churlish that, of the authorities not to allow him to get away with murder, really. So he was formed very much by this rather extraordinary childhood, yes.
I mean, ultimately, the interesting thing that strikes me, David Cameron and Boris Johnson, coming from a background of privilege, went to Eton and Oxford and all of that, the Bullingdon Club and all of that, and yet they both won elections, Andrew. It doesn't seem to have held them back.
This is a point that chippy journalists like you always miss. membership of the Bullingdon Club was
it's
by...
It's a point I've just made. I'm not being chippy. Other journalists. Other less fair-minded journalists, are you?
Exactly. But the thing is, you had to be elected to Bullingdon. And the present foreign minister of Poland was a member of the Bullingdon Club. They had a certain push, some of these Buller people, including Cameron, Osborne, and Boris.
Linda McDougall, are you drawn to this sort of biography, the sort of the politician
not,
on the
not
up?
Not one tiny bit, actually. I was just listening to all these mentions of the Bullingdon Club and thought, well, that should really help me with my knowledge of British politicians. I read Tom Baldwin's extract with enthusiasm at the weekend, and I read it very carefully and just found it so utterly depressing. Marcia Williams, when I was writing the story of a woman we didn't know anything about who was dead and therefore, for the first time, didn't have any possibility of suing me, I suppose. But I gasped when I read Tom Baldwin. It's not that it's not efficient and not compelling, but it just makes the leader of the Labour Party sound like the most boring, responsible, uninspired politician that we've had around for years. If I were Keir Starmer, I wouldn't want to be seen like that. I mean, of course he had a sad time with his family, but a little spark of humour or light, but there was none, and I was very disappointed by that. I think if you're going to write a political biography, then it's awfully useful if someone will read it, and I can imagine vast sort of swathes of people getting bored stiff before they got to chapter four.
Francis, do you think it would have done him more good if someone more independent, more like yourself or Andrew or Linda had done a sort of independent, spirited warts and all, rather than something that clearly, you know, with the possible exception of the revelation that Sue Gray likes citizens' assemblies, that the Labour Party, the Labour machine, the spin doctors are obviously very happy with this. It's more press release than profile.
I think, well, you and I think slightly disagree about the quality of this book. I mean, it's hard to say from the, you know, we've only had the extracts. I actually thought that they were kind of well written, and I agree with the review of Patrick Maguire in the Times about this, that okay, there is a series of controlled explosions, right? We know what's going on here. In a sense, there is some personal details that have been introduced to the public domain in a sympathetic way, and Tom Baldwin has done that, you know, and he has kind of served his political leanings in doing that. So he's controlled the explosions. In less sympathetic hands, they would be, and probably will be going forward, put in a much less sympathetic light, but he's got them out there. But I disagree with Linda. I thought it was really compelling and helped me. I mean, look, we all know that, well, you know, you have to be fairly kind of like asleep at the wheel not to know that Starmer is not a charismatic crafts, you know, a thrill-a-minute guy. He's not Boris Johnson. But I, having read those extracts, I felt I understood a little better his character and his emotional incontinence and what might come from, what might be responsible for that, and forgive a bit along the way. But, you know, hey, maybe I'm...
Softy. Anthony Seldon, do you, if the poll suggests Keir Starmer ends up in number 10, do you relish the idea of Starmer at 10 to add to your collection?
Well, it's always more fun, Matt, writing about somebody who is a lot of fun. And even his best friends wouldn't probably say they relish the prospect of spending 3 weeks on holiday with him in the south of France, or wherever he goes. So Boris Johnson was a lot of fun to write about, but was an absolutely unbelievably, unimaginably awful prime minister. I mean, he was a total disgrace. And so there's a kind of, you know, is there an inverse relationship between funness and effectiveness in office? And so, you know, quite frankly, after a series of pretty ineffectual or highly ineffectual prime ministers, it's going to be good to write about somebody who actually makes the weather. And my goodness, Britain needs a prime minister who knows where the levers are and how to bring about change.
Linda, when it comes to political biographies, I mean, or biographies in general, I think this is true, but I read quite a lot of autobiographies, you know, particularly like, you know, not so much politicians, but, you know, comedians or a whole range of people. Quite often you do skip the sort of the life and times and what their grandfather did and all that. You want to get to the good stuff. And actually, in the story of Keir Starmer, we haven't got to the good stuff yet, have we?
Well, I don't know because it hasn't been published in.
Oh no, I mean, as in he hasn't got to Downing Street yet. In terms of, like, you know, the Marcia Williams stuff, it gets good when she's, you know, advising Howard Wilson and they're getting into government and all of that. That's when if you're into politics, you want to get to the Downing Street bit, don't you?
Well, I'm sure that we obviously want to know about what's going to happen if Keir Starmer becomes Prime Minister. Yes, but I just found it incredibly sort of. Of course, it was well written, but it was uninspiring, and it didn't make me want to rush out and support him and wave a flag for Labour. You know, and I could do with that. I could do with some politicians who gave me hope on either side of the or anywhere in the House of Commons. Quite frankly, I find it also depressing and. I don't want to be a part of a group of biographers who writes stuff that people don't really want to know too much about. I mean, my aim with Marcia was there are so few women written about, so good or bad. My aim was just to tell a story and really to try and find someone who would actually read it, because I know you all read and perhaps I do sometimes, all these biographies of politicians, but it would be so much more exciting if one could get some young people. Dare I suggest, if it had been a racy read about Keir Starmer, it could have done him a power of good.
I'm quite interested in the art of a biography. What's the, if you want that good stuff, the juicy stuff, how do you go about finding it? Is it you know, trying to get to them direct? Is it their rivals? Is it school friends? Is it school reports, as Andrew was talking about? Where do you go when you're putting together a biography to get the good stuff? Anthony Selder, first of all. Oh, he's gone. Anthony's not there. What about Andrew?
Well,
Anthony, there he is.
I am here. And any biography is critically dependent, Matt, upon the sources. And those biographies, we love, of literary figures or great artists, figures in history, are nothing unless you've got top quality material that gets inside the head of the person in a way that is revealing. We're all fascinated by other human beings. We don't really want to know that they were head of a select committee and produced a particular report on a particular day. I mean, that is just terribly boring. But knowing what is going on inside somebody's psyche, that's interesting. And part of the difficulty is that people don't have time to write diaries and they don't have time to write letters. And so you're much more reliant upon people's oral testimony.
That's interesting.
You know, that's a big fact of biographers today.
Andrew Jimson, where did you find the good stuff?
Well, I talked to a lot of people who've been at school and Oxford and with Boris Johnson. I talked to one very, very amusing man who said that while he was at Eton with Boris, people said, well, it's all very well to behave like this at Eton, but he won't be able to behave like that at Oxford. At Oxford, they said, all very well at Oxford, they won't be able to do this in London, and so on throughout his entire career. And of course, people eventually said, you can't behave like that as Prime Minister, but it had got him a long way.
And what about you, Francis? Where do you find the good stuff?
I'm afraid it's shoe leather for us. I mean, I remember there was a moment when David Cameron's then press secretary, George Eustace, said, how many people have you spoken to? I said, oh, I think it's about, we're up to about 250 now. And at that point, the non-access became slightly more access. And we realised that we were prepared to do the hard yards.
And what about you, Linda? Because it's obviously slightly different if you're doing a biography of someone who's died and lots of the other people involved had died. So how did you find the good stuff?
Well, access was really problematic because Marcia Williams has two sons living. One, a sort of senior figure in the City of London, and the other living in Stratford-on-Avon. And they will not, they don't want anything to do with talking about their mum. Now, that's a bit of a problem for a start. Neither of them would have anything to do with me. The one who works in the City of London has three daughters, young, I think, university students, who one wonders, you know, don't they want to know what their grandma got up to? But so I was in a very difficult situation, because when it came to the private life of Marcia, I had to dig incredibly hard. And I did find someone who was her best friend at school. And I was able to talk to her sister-in-law, who had been Joe Kagan's secretary. So it was hard won. Every fact in that book was hard won, because people, although Marcia was dead, people just wanted nothing to do with her, and they didn't want to talk about it, unless, of course, they were the stories that I retold when I interviewed people like Joe Haynes and Bernard Donoghue, who were obviously the experts. And Bernard Donoghue, his diaries were a wonderful source of accurate information about what he perceived when he was working with her on a day-to-day basis. So I guess every biography is different. And whatever you would say about Marcia, she was neither dull nor boring, nor a member of the Bullingdon Club.
Absolutely, which is why it made for such a great read. Linda McDougall, great to speak to you, author of Marcia Williams, The Life and Times of Baroness Falconder. We also heard from Sir Anthony Selton, who has written biographies of John Major, Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, David Cameron, Theresa May, and Boris Johnson. Andrew Jimson, who wrote two volumes of biography of Boris Johnson, The Rise and Fall of a Troublemaker at number 10, and Francis Elliott, biographer of David Cameron, who with James Hanning wrote Cameron, Practically a Conservative. Now, let's find out whether the nation's booksellers are gripped by the prospect of another political backstory. Joining me now is president of the Booksellers Association, owner of Village Books in Dulwich. She's returned to the show, Hazel Broadfoot. How are you?
Good morning. Very well, thank you.
Good to have you with us. Are you clearing the shelves to stock the backstory of Keir Starmer?
No, in a word.
And why is that? Is that because political books don't sell? Is it particularly political biographies? What's the issue?
Political books do sell. There are two things. They have to be well written. And I think it helps if the author has some kind of backstory or a hinterland. So if I was looking at last year's political books, the standout bestseller in independent bookshops was Rory Stewart's book, Politics on the Edge.
And the other night when we were at the Parliamentary Book Awards, you said that he'd sort of almost saved independent bookshops, that it really had made a difference, the enthusiasm.
I wouldn't say it saved independent bookshops, but it was a book that worked very well for independent bookshops, because I know he was a Conservative, but he's almost apolitical now. And his podcast is hugely popular. And he is hugely popular, not in the Houses of Commons, but he's popular with the general public, and he can write. I think the Times and the Sunday Times don't always agree about things, but they both agreed that was a political book of the year.
I was cruelly overlooked in that one, Hazel.
To give you an idea of the scale, my bookshop is tiny, and I sold over 500 copies of that book.
Wow.
David Cameron's book, which was a tome, it was 800 pages. I think we maybe sold three. So it really does depend on if the politician can write and if they've got something interesting to say. Alan Johnson's book, This Boy, did very, very well when it was published, and it still sells. It's become standard stock for any bookshop in their politics section, as do Chris Mullin's books. The View from the Foothills, I think, is essential reading for new MPs.
It's really interesting. I suppose it's a bit of the sort of somebody who stepped outside the political circle, if you like. You know, the David Cameron one, there was this sort of slight sense, well, Theresa May had replaced him, he probably wasn't going to, you know, blow up colleagues who are still in government and that sort of thing. Whereas a bit of distance from politics, whether that's, you know, because you've moved politically in the case of Roy Stewart, or just, you know, the passage of time, actually maybe creates a bit of honesty, a bit of self-reflection, a bit of humour, a bit of behind the scenes. And they're all sort of ingredients that we're bluntly not going to get necessarily from a book about Keir Starmer when he's on the cusp of entering number 10.
I agree. And a really good example of that is Chris Patten, who published last year his Hong Kong diaries. And, you know, that was quite a gap since he left Hong Kong. And that was a book which did very, very well. And you know, he's an interesting man.
It's really fascinating. That. How's Planes, Trains and Toilet Doors doing, Hazel?
Well, it did very well for us. I listened to your show and I like it. And it's a nice book to dip into. It was a very popular Christmas present.
Fabulous.
Not quite as popular as Rory Stewart.
Yeah, all right. Stop talking about Rory Stewart, Hazel. He gets enough publicity. Hazel, it's always lovely to speak to you. Glad it's all going well at Village Books. That's Hazel Broadfoot there from Village Books in Dulwich and president of the Booksellers Association. And that's all we've got time for on today's episode of the podcast. Don't forget you can get in touch. You can email me matt@times.radio, matt@times.radio, or WhatsApp us on 033-003-2353. That's 033-003-2353. In fact, it'd be nice to hear from listeners from outside the UK if you're listening around the world. But for now, for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional, unprofessional. So if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.